Let's go. Admission to the Lord's Supper. So you have a CTCR document in front of you, which you've all had to read other times for other classes, and I had you take a look at it one more time. This is my desire that you would do that. And I don't want to belabor that. I think the argument there is pretty straightforward. It's a heavily exegetical argument. And then you have the paper I added to that, which is trying to make some systematic points and adding on to that paper. And if you read my paper carefully enough, you realize I'm assuming this document and pretty much affirming it. And I take its argument to be on track. And then I just wanted to make a few more points. And my essay is geared much more toward the systematic side of things. And that was the intent of that. So, reactions or thoughts as we get started on this whole discussion. Yes, Aaron.
So there is a part in the CTCR document where it quotes the Solemn Declaration in a few points where it basically says that any Christian can come to the altar worthily, even the weakest of Christians. And then it basically makes the argument, this is actually a contextualization of what was going on at the time, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
As I was reading it, my initial thought was, do our confessions actually agree on this issue? Because that seems to disagree with some other areas.
Well, what do the confessions say? I actually quote the relevant part in my article, which is Small Catechism, so that he who knows that Christ is his Savior knows he's aware of his sin, he's a worthy recipient. Done. So, pretty much. But see, the key is making a bigger move here, okay? All right, but we'll get that in just a second. And we'll make the fundamental move, then we'll spend some time to talk about this, because perennially this has a fair amount of interest. At least it should have. So anyway, other reactions? Yeah?
In the very end of the CTCR, it has the discussion about, it has the question formats, and it has the part where it talks about snowbirds. And I was just wondering, in light of...
What is a snowbird?
The snowbird coming in and, moving into the congregation for a little while, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh.
I was wondering, in light of our conversation about church, mm-hmm. should the snowbird thing really bother us? If you're just coming in for a little, for 3 months or something like that?
It's kind of a big deal if you're trying to figure out what membership is. And that's not irrelevant here. Because if you're going to be the church, you're going to align yourself with a congregation. You're going to do that because you're going to recognize I have a responsibility, I need to be part of things. And that's that whole church discipline thing. You have a responsibility to others. You can't just beg off. And so one of the main reasons to be part of the church is there are other Christians. I've got to be there with them, so I'll do that. So the idea of, which congregation is mine, in a sense, those people are functioning with two congregations. That's kind of what's going on there, and I think that's what you need to acknowledge. And then and kind of come to terms with that and decide where their home congregation is. Maybe it is where they spend their winters. Maybe it's where they spend their summers. They need to figure that out and come to terms with that is what I would say. All right. Peter.
Tag on to that, we as seminarians, what we deem as our home congregation, because the congregation I'm actually a member at, I don't think I've been there more than one Sunday in the last 2 years.
Well, you're doing better than some.
Okay.
No, you guys are in a very strange situation, and when you're a student, and when you're doing field work, and you're doing vicarage, you find yourself in a very odd sort of situation. And so it's just part of being in that nebulous world, which is one of the reasons why I think it's helpful to identify this community as the church, and then you identify this, which I don't think is wrong. I made that case earlier. All right. Yep, Caleb.
I may have missed it, but did you make a practical solution to pastoral discretion and what to change communion practices? Does that make sense the way I'm wording that? Like, is there a solution that you proposed, or did I miss it?
What would the solution be?
Yeah, compared to like just printing something in the bulletin.
Oh, I think it's implicit. And I'm not suggesting there's only one way to do it, but I would say basically the understanding should be this is this congregation's celebration. Those who aren't part of the congregation need to talk to the pastor, period. Mm-hmm. Period. And you can put that in the bulletin, and that's fine. But you see, it's basically anybody who's not part of this community, come talk to me, because I'm responsible for this community. And to me, that's the obvious that's the easiest answer. That's the way out. That's the right way to do it. And so everything should come through the one who's responsible. And he just has the conversation. Therefore, if somebody shows up at when the first hymn is being sung, too late. So basically, they're going to sit it out. That's what's going on there.
So are we just assuming that the pastor, or are we just assuming that all members of the community have the same confession of communion?
They obviously do because they're part of the community.
Even if they don't.
Even if they don't know it.
Okay. So if they don't know there.
Even if they don't know it, because when they align themselves with the community, that's their community. And I take that pretty seriously. And that's a key part of the whole argument is you're part of the community. And I'll have something more to say about that too.
Yeah, that'd be great because I really feel like there are so many people, so many members of churches.
Oh yeah, who are clueless.
Who are a member that they don't know what they believe.
Oh, I know.
Or they believe the complete opposite.
Oh, I know. I acknowledge
that.
I acknowledge that. I acknowledge that. And that's going to be more of a problem in some congregations than others, depending on what the catechesis is like. And you kind of probably could guess where I'm going to come down on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm excited.
All right. Saw a hand in the back row. Yeah.
Yeah, my question was related to that. And I'm just curious to get some of your thoughts on what it looks like and what it means to be included into the community of believers, like in a mission field setting.
Yeah.
But it sounds like we'll get there.
Oh, yeah. All right, now, okay, one more. Yes.
All of this seems really great in a smaller congregational setting, but in a congregation that's larger, how is this a practical thing that you can do?
Don't, just ignore it. Just ignore it. Because big churches matter more than little churches. And they're practically like synods. Who cares what they should just do their thing because they're serving people so well and they're just really showing people what Jesus is like. It doesn't matter. There you go. How's that for an answer? How's that for a definitive answer? No, maybe not. All right, let's think about this. Now, so we have the first big question of worthiness. So what makes a person worthy for the Lord's Supper? Now, we should say right off the bat, the big question here, and obviously the whole thing we're talking about today is the mission to the Lord's Supper. So we'll put that up here since I probably won't be using that a lot anyway. And we're going to be talking about this from the context of practice and communion practice and specifically who should be there. And what we're really talking about today, of course, is closed communion. All right. And so the first big question is this whole thing of worthy. And we are then going to talk about closed communion. And as I say in my essay, it is closed communion with the ED. And let's not get all weird about this. People like, this kind of happened in the 70s. Oh, is it close or closed? And so close was nice. It just sounded nicer. You know, it's close. We're all close there, you know. And closed sounds so nasty. So I have two people to this day who get all weirded out about, I'll say closed communion. Oh, you mean close communion. I say, no, I meant closed. Closed, duh. That's what it is. Because if it's close and it's only for those who are in the same fellowship, guess what? If you're not part of that fellowship, it's closed. That's what it is. And that's what the term has always been. It's been there since the earliest days. And when people talk about close communion, usually what it means is they're close to getting it right. But they're probably not. All right. That's been my experience. So close communion doesn't cut it. It's closed communion. And the practice, by the way, how old is this practice? When did this idea start?
Right away, church.
Yeah, let's talk about the Didache, 2nd century. And what was the practice in those first couple centuries of the church? You had people who were coming in to join the church who had been baptized, or actually not yet. They were in the process. They were confessing Christ, and they were being catechized. How long did that typically take? 2 years. 2 years of catechesis. During that 2 years of catechesis, they could come to the worship service, but when it was time for the Lord's Supper and the kiss of peace, what happened? They were excused from the building, to the doors. Out they went, closed the doors behind them. Who was left? Those who had been baptized and were catechized, who were part of the full fellowship, they celebrated the sacrament. Not even the catechumens were allowed to stay. Closed communion or not? Sort of, yeah, pretty remarkably. So that was the practice. So the idea of kind of loosening things up is a thoroughly modern idea, completely modern idea. By modern meaning somewhere in the 17, 18, 19, you know, somewhere there. So it's within the last few centuries this has come into play, and it's really picked up steam ever since the rise of the ecumenical movement a century and a half ago or so. That's when things really start to take off on this. This is a new idea. The open communion is a new idea. This is the ancient practice of the church. Always has been. And it's worth remembering also that if you go to the Roman Catholic Church, any Roman Catholic Church that's being faithful, and you want to take communion, what are they going to tell you? Are you Catholic? No, then you can't, unless you get a special dispensation from the Archbishop and you got to go talk to them and get all kinds of green lights and all kinds of stuff. No, you can't. In fact, even if you go to the Cathedral Basilica in the central West End, which you should do sometime before you leave here, when you walk in the door, there's usually a little card there that says, thanks for being here. Walk around, make yourselves at home. Check it out. Look at all the mosaics. It's pretty cool. But if you're here when you're celebrating the sacrament and you're not part of the Catholic Church, don't take it. That's what it says. Sounds like closed communion to me. And that's what it is. So it's not like it's just some weird LCMS thing and you're all just hung up and you're all Pharisees and it's just weird and you got to get over this. And I've heard this implied so often. We just got to get over this. Give me a break. It's the lax practice. That's the new thing. Just that it's widespread in our context in America doesn't make it universal at all. Now, the big issue then comes down to this question of worthy. And even this word worthy kind of sticks in your craw, doesn't it? Worthy. No one's worthy. We're theologians of the cross. We know better. No one's worthy. And yet, this is the word. And where does this word come from? Yeah. So we got the worthiness thing. And then Luther picks up on this. And Luther uses this extensively in the Small Catechism. In fact, it's this whole driving question. What makes you worthy? Now, context. What was the issue? In Luther's day, to be a worthy recipient, what did you need to do? You needed to fast. You needed to make sure you went to confession and you had seen the priest and you'd been to your private confession. You had to go to confession. You had to fast. You had to do certain things to be able to be a worthy recipient. Didn't get those criteria done, you weren't worthy. So when Luther is asking the question, what makes you worthy, that's what he's thinking about. And so he's saying, guess what? There's no performance to do here. Fasting's fine. That's all right. No problem with that. But it's not a requirement. There's only a couple things you have to have to be a worthy recipient. So what are the criteria to be a worthy recipient? We need it. We can do this because it's scriptural and it's confessional. What are the criteria to be a worthy recipient?
Discern the true presence.
All right. So you've gone for the big one already, which is the real presence. Okay. We'll have to talk about that. What else?
Recognize you're a sinner.
All right. So there's a recognition of sin. Okay. So a recognition of your sinfulness, that needs to be there. And then there's another thing.
Faith in Jesus.
What's that?
Faith in Jesus.
Yeah, faith in Christ. Oh, yeah, okay. And typically we use a word to go with that, which is baptized. Okay, so we would say baptized believers who are aware of their sinfulness and recognize the real presence, that makes you a real worthy recipient. And of course, recognition of sinfulness is also the desire to amend my life. So all this then plays into what makes you a worthy recipient. So worth has nothing to do with doing stuff. Worth has to do with, are you trusting Christ? Do you know you're a sinner? And do you know what's being given in the sacrament? Do you know what's really going on here? And of course, the key text is that phrase in 1 Corinthians, to recognize the body, right? Okay? So, recognizing the body, which creates a fair amount of discussion, because what might Paul have in mind there? Well, yeah, maybe he means the body of the church, or alternatively, maybe he means Christ's body. And we encounter immediately the deliciously powerful truth of the whole thing, which is?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Why do we have to choose? To recognize Christ's body is to recognize his body, which is the church. There's that identification anyway. And so really, if we're going to get this thing straight, it's not a matter of picking sides. We need to recognize both aspects. And in the context of 1 Corinthians and all the divisions and all the schisms going on there, recognizing the church clearly is going on there, but also recognizing this is Christ's body being given is also obviously an aspect of it. And I think it's always wrong to pick one or the other. And that's pretty much the way the CTCR document argues. Okay? Right? And the CTCR document goes a long way in trying to address all the questions, does doctrinal unity matter? And the answer is yes. Because for Paul, doctrine always matters, and it suggests we could just have unity but have doctrinal division. Paul doesn't work this way. And of course, it's always important to remember, you cannot take truths that we're trying to ask today, like what about the Methodists from down the road, and apply them in Paul's day, because that's an anachronistic sort of question. He didn't have Methodists down the road. It was a non-issue. So Paul doesn't have to deal with these things. So when you have an argument from silence like, well, Paul never says, well, yeah, so why do we expect him to? That's not his context. So that's just kind of a sidebar. All right, now, this is what makes you a worthy recipient. This is the criteria. And this then is the driving concern, and most good, pious LCMS people I know recognize this need, right? Because if you go to the sacrament not recognizing the presence of Christ, what's going to happen to you? You're going to get in trouble because you're monkeying around with God's grace. You're taking pearls and playing like they don't matter. And that's serious business. You're mucking around with dynamite. In fact, St. Paul tells us that some of you are sick and have even fallen asleep. That's not cool. So worthiness is kind of important. But often, this is precisely where the discussion stops. And this is what I find so problematic in most of our discussions, because we act like this is all that matters. Okay? But it's not the only question. Because frankly, worthiness is really dealing only with the individual and his relationship with God. It's a vertical realm question. So it's all about coram Deo stuff. Am I, the believer, on track with God? Do I recognize the gift? Do I know my sinfulness before God? Do I want to amend my life? Do I recognize what he's giving to me here? It's all about me and God. If I believe the right things, I'm a worthy recipient. No, I'm receiving the body and blood of Christ. I belong. That makes you a worthy recipient. But there's a whole other aspect to communion, is there not? And isn't that Paul's driving concern when he's addressing this to the Corinthians? What's the problem there? They're going ahead and having the meal, and then they're doing it with all this division. You got some people at the table, others standing around the outside of the table because they can't fit because it's, you know, happened in the house church, and they're the leftovers, literally. And some people are getting drunk, and others are having nothing. And then they're celebrating the Lord's Supper. What kind of unity is this? So what's the problem in the Corinthian church? It's the fractured horizontal unity. That's the very thing Paul's after. He's saying you guys are missing the boat. You're not acting like one church. Knock it off. And he calls them back to recognizing what God is doing. So there's clearly also a whole other part of this discussion, which is the horizontal aspect. And that's the Coram Mundo stuff. And this is the stuff that most LCMS pious people start to limp on and get really messed up, and they get kind of hung up because it's where they don't quite get it. And I think one of the reasons, really, frankly, is because Luther never addresses this in his small catechism. He doesn't talk about it. It just never comes up. Because in the small catechism, Luther's primary concern is helping people know whether they should be going to the altar. And the answer is, do you trust Christ? Don't worry about your fasting. Don't worry about your performance. Don't worry about having been to confession. Just ask yourself, do you need what God is giving there and you believe he's giving it? If you say yes to those things, get yourself up there right now because you need the sacrament. You're worthy. That's what he's after. Luther's after helping the person know that he should be receiving the sacrament. He is not trying to address the question we're addressing today about whether or not the ELCA friends should be coming to the sacrament. That's not even close to what he's trying to talk about anywhere in the small catechism. And to suggest, well, the confessions just teaches this, is just inane. Because you're acting like, well, it doesn't say anything, so therefore, obviously, Paul or Luther didn't care. That's simply not the case. Simply not true. All right. Now, what opens up then is this whole other aspect, and this we need to say, wait a minute, what's going on here? And I'm going to suggest a word for this, and the word I'm going to use is the one I use in my paper, which is appropriate. Now, the paper that you read, which is published in CTQ, I actually did the footnote says this, I did this as a conference paper in southern Minnesota when I got asked to come up there and talk about communion practice. And their MO was to have one guy talking in favor of closed communion, and another guy talking about why a more open practice was an acceptable good thing. So that was the game plan. And so it turned out the other guy who was going up was a revered pastor from the St. Louis area, who I knew, and he came up to do the other side. So I did my thing, read this paper, and then he did his thing and did his shtick, and I was ready to go. I was so excited. What's he going to say? You know, it's going to be great. You know, he's just trying to defend this. And what's fascinating, which is fascinating, was his entire argument why we should be opening up our practice and be a little more lenient on this thing is, well, he just told story after story after story about how he had done this and good things had happened. and how I've been had just shown love to people and had really helped in a hard situation where somebody was really having a tough time, and he let them commune, and wow, it was just powerful. It really, really made people feel great, and it was good. And that was it. And I found that stunning, because essentially you should be able to recognize what's going on here. There's no theology behind his argument at all. He's got nothing but existential, personal, relational pragmatics driving it. That's it. There's no theology to support his view. He could have come up with something, frankly, but he didn't even bother. I was stunned. It's like, dude, you're just handing me the victory here. I mean, it's, you know, that's what I was thinking. It wasn't a debate. There was no victor. It was just a discussion. All right. So this is the thing I introduced in this paper, is this idea of appropriate. And I got a little pushback on this, that appropriate seemed a little weak, but I think this is exactly the right word, because it's actually the word that Paul uses in Corinthians also when he talks about it's not appropriate for, you know, certain things to be happening. And he uses this language also in the context of it's not appropriate to be taking your brother to court. It's not appropriate. It's not fitting. It's not seemly. And so this is actually the right word here. So appropriate is asking a different question. Appropriate is asking the question, am I in unity with those that I'm communing with? Is there unity? And are we actually celebrating together? Is there unity? Is it appropriate for me to be communing at this altar? That's a different kind of question. Okay? And what this opens up then is a couple of words that are broached in the CTCR document, and there's only about a paragraph or two where they're mentioned, just in passing, but to me this is kind of one of the most important contributions of that CTCR document, and I want to expand on it quite a bit, is thinking about this person, the potential communicant, in two ways. We need to think about him as an individual, and we need to think about him as a confessor. And those two words map precisely to worthiness and appropriateness. As an individual, we're asking the question, is this person a worthy individual? Do they believe in Christ? Do they repent? Are they recognizing the presence of Christ? If it's yes, 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 they are a worthy individual. But now as a confessor, it's a different animal. It's a different aspect. Because as a confessor, what's going on is this. When this person is being considered, not only do we ask the question of the worthiness, we ask the question of their appropriateness. What is their confession? Are they confessing with all those others who are communing, or aren't they? Because in fact, and here's the crux of the argument, when you go to the altar and receive the sacrament, you are confessing with that altar. Your presence is admission and approval and confession. This is my confession. Now, that's a huge part of the whole discussion, that understanding of what's really going on. So the sacrament is an expression of unity, which is how Paul treats it, and the CTCR document works hard to establish this case. And this is the point then. So the sacrament doesn't create unity. The sacrament is a celebration of unity that is there. So we ask the question, is this person an individual who's worthy, and is this a person, a confessor, whose confession is the same as this altar? If it's yes, they are an appropriate recipient. If it's no, they're not. That's closed communion. And closed communion needs to take into account both aspects and not just one. And most people just talk about this and get all hung up on this and get really confused as to why this would matter at all. And you need to work hard to educate people to see both aspects of this. It's a communion not just with God, but with everybody else at the altar. So when you're kneeling at the altar communing, you're in communion with every other brother and sister there. One cup, one loaf. It's the whole point of the discussion. Now, a couple things I want to go further, then I'll get your questions, Peter. Give a concrete example. So, there's a daughter of the congregation who's grown up and got married and left and come back, and then she comes back for Christmas time, and she was confirmed in this church, and she wants to receive the sacrament, but she is no longer a member of this church. In fact, she's joined the Presbyterian church, because that's where her husband goes, and she's not LCMS anymore. And so now she wants to come back and receive the sacrament. So, she knows that Jesus is her Savior, she knows she's a repentant sinner, and she knows that even though she's going to a Presbyterian church, she knows it's no symbol. She believes what she always believed. She's still a Lutheran, and she knows when she takes a sacrament, it's really getting the body and blood of Christ. It's not a symbol at all. So is she a worthy recipient?
As an individual.
Yes, she is a worthy recipient. You see how this is going? She's met the criteria. She's a worthy recipient. Now, the next question is, what's her confession?
Presbyterian.
It's a Presbyterian confession. Even though in her heart she still believes what Lutherans believe, she is outwardly confessing with the Presbyterian Church. Sorry, but she is. Whether she believes or not, that's where she has aligned herself. She's confessing with that church. That's her confession. So now for her to confess at our altar is, frankly, not honest. She's not really in unity anymore. That's kind of a bummer. And so she's not an appropriate recipient. Worthy, yes. Appropriate, no. She can go back to her own altar and commune. That's great. And get some nice bread and wine. And that's all. Because it's a Reformed ordinance with no sacramental grace going on, as far as I'm concerned. But she's not an appropriate recipient at your altar. That's how this starts to work out. And so now you can go the other way, too. Suppose you have a member of your congregation, and he is a member of your congregation, and he believes and he confesses everything the same way, but you have been dealing with this guy on some issue that he's struggling with, and he's not repentant, and you just put him on the minor ban. So is he an appropriate recipient? Yeah, he's still a member. Is he a worthy recipient? No. We're not. He's not repenting of his sin. So he's not worthy. So you see how this can cut both ways? And this is why the responsibility of the pastor to exercise oversight is critical. Now, when I usually present this paper, I have to work pretty hard at establishing that part of this. But you guys should have all been reading that part and thinking, yeah, fine. Get it. He's the shepherd. He's responsible. Hopefully I pounded that into your heads by now. And so that part of the argument you should have had no problem with. You're right. I am the one who is the steward of the mysteries of God. I'm the one who's responsible. The Ezekiel thing comes into play here as well. I'm responsible. And so clearly it's the pastor's call whether or not he's supposed to be doing this. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about here with closed communion then. You need to pay attention to both aspects. It's not acceptable just to do this and say, oh, he believes in Jesus. Cool. We're all good. And not actually attend to this as well. They both need to be taken care of. Now, the last thing I'll say, then I'll hit Peter's question, is this. This actually is not nearly as offensive as you think it is. And everybody gets so weirded out and so wishy-washy on this. Oh, I'd be really afraid to do it. Don't be such a wimp. People, this is not as weird as you think it is. And when you tell people, hey, this sacrament that we celebrate here is really important. It is a celebration of Christ's true body and blood coming to us. You're getting the body and blood of Christ when you receive this sacrament. And when you come up to this altar, you're saying you agree with everything we teach at this place. It's pretty serious. And so that's what we're all about. And so that's why before you commune with us, you really probably need to know what we believe and teach. So you can understand if you want to be here at this altar or not. That's part of what's going on here. Most people, when you lay it out like this, are not going to be like, what? You're telling me I can't? It's my divine right. And of course, now you're talking to a foolish Western American, and you got a whole other set of problems. But that's not that odd of a thing to say. And I try to make a couple of illustrations in my paper about that as well. You know, you don't go to a military exercise and say, hey, I want to do that too. You watch from the stands, and you participate by being a spectator. But you don't go down and start marching around the field because it looks cool. Hey, I want to do that. It looks like fun. Hey, I want to get down there. Don't tell me I can't. Well, yeah, we're going to tell you you can't. You're not part of us. Sit down. You know, and it's like, well, why do we do that with communion? We get so stupid on this kind of stuff. And the other thing that's important to recognize is even the millennial generation is really into community and fellowship and this close communities. Well, good grief, what are we talking about here? Closed communion is all about being the community that we are together and celebrating that. And if you're not part of that, you're not ready to come and celebrate yet. We would love to have everybody coming and celebrating. I would love to have you part of this community, but you see, there's part of growing into the community, and you don't get there by just coming running up to the altar the first Sunday you happen to show up. You need to learn about what it means to be part of this community, and when the time's right, you're going to be celebrating everything we do around here together. What's offensive about that? What is offensive? What's telling people, I don't think you're good enough? What's judgmental about any of that? It's simply expressing, this is what's going on here, and this is how we understand it. We ask you to please respect that. And if they don't, they don't. But you're not being offensive. There's nothing horrendous about that at all. All right, Peter.
What should our response be to a brother pastor who claims to be in statu confessionis at a circuit meeting or something like that? What should we?
Oh, that's a different animal, Peter. And that one just
it seems to go fit into this appropriate.
Well, yeah, it does. In a sense, what you need to say is, and this gets to Caleb's question, so I'll speak to that too. Here's the thing. When you join a congregation, that's your congregation, and that's your confession. You say so, right? Is this congregation's confession mine? Yes. Now, does that mean they've read the whole entire Book of Concord? Probably not. But usually what we do say somewhere in that little right is, as you've come to know it from the small catechism, at least that, right? So in other words, that's their confession. And people get this. People get this. And I put a lot of stock in this. So in other words, every single member of my congregation confesses what we confess in this church, even if they don't know it. And it's my job as pastor to make sure they know it. And over the course of 10 years, hopefully they'll get it somewhere along the way. But you see, people get this, and I experience this all the time. I'll have people in a Bible class who I'll be teaching about something, they'll raise their hand and say, tell me what we believe about the second coming of Christ. So I'll say, okay, here's what we believe. We're not millennialists. We don't believe this kind of stuff. We believe this and believe this. Then they'll say, oh, okay, thanks for telling me what I believe. You know what I mean? And we don't even think twice about it because they have just said, I'm part of this church. Tell me what I believe about this. I want to know what I believe. And it's kind of backwards when you think about it, but no, it's actually quite appropriate because they're norming themselves by that confession of that church, which is exactly right. And so I don't have to have, and this is where you get all the pushback. You know, always get this saying, so you're saying there's a test. How much do you have to know before you can take communion? I would say, how much do you have to know? Jesus died for me, rose again. I need his grace. He's coming to me here. Done. That's enough. And then everything else, of course I agree with it because I'm part of this church. And when I come to know it, I accept it. And when the problem, and if it comes to the point where somebody says, here's what we teach, and the guy says, oh, wait a minute, I got a problem with that, we say, all right, let's talk. Let's figure this thing out. Let's get this hashed out. And we talk, and we talk, and we meet, and one or two things will happen. He'll say, okay, I can live with that. I'm still maybe kind of sorting it out, or I just can't live with that. And at that point, he probably will leave, or you'll help him find a congregation or direct him somewhere where he can fit in better. Ideally, he's going to learn to yield his self-assertion to the teaching of the church. That's the best thing. But in other words, everybody's confessing what we confess here. There is no minimum requirement. And so I take that very seriously. And I agree with you, Caleb. I might think my people probably have no clue about the non-reciprocity of the second gainus maiestaticum. But if I tell it to them, are they going to be on board? You bet they will. You bet. Do they have to know it to take the sacrament? Of course not. See, this also opens up a whole other discussion about First Communion and pulling it apart from confirmation, which is an exceedingly good idea, should happen. And if it hasn't happened yet where you're going, get it happening. It's an exceedingly good idea because what do you need to know to take communion? Just this. Just this. And so how old does a kid have to be to get this? Well, it's going to vary, isn't it? My criteria, and I say this kind of seriously, is when the child can take the sacrament without giggling, they're ready. And if it's not like, ooh, I just drank wine, and you're not ready, kid, you know? Seriously, you know, that's kind of how I look at it. So, man, I think we could be pushing the age down as far as I'm concerned. Why are we making all these intellectual requirements? Who says you have to have an intellectual understanding? And it always fries me when people say, well, you know, you have to understand what's going on. Well, I guess I can't take it then. I have no idea what's going on. How is Jesus there? He is. How? I don't know. But man, he is. You got to understand it. I don't understand it. In with and under, what's that mean? I have no idea where he is. He's not hiding underneath it. He's not, where is he? But he's here because he said, oh, seriously. I mean, let's in with and under. What's that even mean? Is Luther just stringing together three prepositions? He means, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. But he's there because he promised it. Don't have to explain it. That's the promise with transubstantiation. You're explaining too much. We can't explain anything. We just take it on faith. And you see, when can you take it on faith? 5 years old? 6 years old? Probably. So people who get kind of concerned about first graders, well, yeah, at least. Come on, people. Let's stop making intellectual rules about this.
Faith of a child.
Exactly. Adam.
So believing in the church as the local body, but also the church as the whole, and them being the same, the pastor who comes in visiting on vacation, or
yep.
the grandma who comes in after graduation, they tell you we're LCMS elsewhere, mm-hmm. but you're welcome to join us? Or
it's going to depend on that church. See, my understanding is this, and I try to address this in the essay too. One of the things we've got to overcome is this my rights mentality. This I have a, what's the word I'm looking for? Entitlement, that's the word I want. Yes, thank you. This whole entitlement mentality. I'm entitled to the sacrament. If Jesus is being offered, I get him, darn it. It's my right as a Christian. Nobody has a right to keep me from Jesus. No, that's totally wrong thinking. That's American Enlightenment thinking. That's not Christian thinking. My understanding is this. If I go to a congregation and they're celebrating the Lord's Supper, it's their celebration. And I'm a guest. So I need to talk to the right people and say, is it okay if I join you for your celebration? And if they say, you're invited, fine. And the criteria he might ask me about, are you an LCMS member? I'll say yes, which is just shorthand for, are all these things true? And are you a confessor like we are? That's all it is. It's not like I get out my flying cross card. There I see, I'm good. Zoop. You know, we could even have a little UPC reader, you know. Ding, ding, oh, sorry. No, that's a Presbyterian card, you're not welcome. You know, but you see, it's not like you've got the right card. That's not the point. The point is, are you confessing with us? And the LCMS criteria is just shorthand for you're confessing with us. Now, you could even have a situation where that congregation might be saying, the pastor might say, you know what, our celebration today is kind of really special, and there's some things going on, and your presence would actually kind of be a weird thing. I'd ask you not to commune. What would my response be? What should it be? You got it, dude. I'll worship with you, and I'll be here, but that's fine. Do I get bent out of shape? No, it's not my right. It's his prerogative. He wants to invite me? Awesome. He doesn't? That's okay, too. So it's like going to somebody's house for Thanksgiving. Want to eat? Sure. You know? But you don't walk into, you know, knock on the door, eating Thanksgiving. Oh, great, I'm coming on in. Where's the chair? You see how weird that is? And see, we just got to get our whole mentality right. We've got to start thinking about this the right way. And we've got to start training our congregation to see it this way. Drives me nuts when congregations don't see it this way. And we'll talk about maybe that too with a little more time. Aaron.
It seems to me a lot of this comes down to like an individualism type thing, because like for example
Absolutely.
With the you know, this girl who was confirmed in this church and left, and now she's a Presbyterian, but she's not really a Presbyterian. I mean,
but is she or not? That's the whole point.
So then she has like her confession is not really true.
That's exactly right. She's being a hypocrite, isn't she? That's not cool. So someone probably should sit down and talk to her about where she's going to church. Who wants to have that conversation?
Yeah, well, she shows up, though, and her confession is, you know, aligned with our confession.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
Even if she says?
Because she's confessing where she's a member. See, it's the same thing with a guy who joins the lodge. I'm a Mason, and I just go because I like the low prices I get on alcohol. But I don't really believe this stuff. Really? So you're going, so are you a Mason or not? You are. So if you're a Mason, do you confess with them? Well, I don't really believe that stuff. But then why are you aligned with them? You're being inconsistent, and you're being a hypocrite. That's the sorry reality. We don't want to face that, but that's exactly what's going on here. So the problem is, she is precisely what you said. Well, she believes the same thing, right? But her confession doesn't line up. That's the issue.
If she really believed it, she wouldn't be going to
the
Presbyterian.
If she really believed it, she would have never joined the Presbyterian church, because she would say, there's no way I can go to a church where you give me phony sacraments. Won't do it. I don't care how much I love you, dude. And that's a whole other problem. Oh, you might talk about mixed marriages. And I got some opinions about that too, but that's not the topic for the day. And that's why you don't let your kids date anybody who's not Missouri Synod. In all seriousness. We lament, oh, my kid married a Catholic. Well, how did that happen? Well, they dated him. Oh, yeah. Maybe we should make those decisions first date instead of at the end, at the time when they're getting engaged. A little too late then, but that's another topic for another time. See, and I'm so unpopular, all these crazy ideas. But tell me where I'm wrong, and I'll hear you. All right.
So does it just come down to knowing? Because, I feel like I heard Caleb ask about a member of your congregation mm-hmm. who is confessing, but... Like, they're just there because, well, I should always be in a church, so
yeah,
I don't really care what the Lutherans believe. I'm part of church, but I'm going to keep going. You
right.
know that. So, like, what makes that better than...
Well, it doesn't... I'm not... being a bad pastor doesn't... No excuse for that. So if you're a shepherd who really doesn't know the status of his flock, are you responsible for that? You're supposed to know the status of your flock. You should know your flock. So if I have a member of my flock who's just perfunctory going through the motions, is that a problem?
Seriously, you're saying,
problem.
Is your thought our churches need to be smaller so that you can?
Our churches need to be churches. That's my thought. Our churches need to function like churches, like Paul's 1 Corinthians church, where he holds people accountable. They hold each other accountable. We actually need to know what's going on. And that does raise some interesting questions on the line of Adam's question. What about the size factor? And I guess this is a good time to need to talk about that. There is no right number on a size, but I would suggest that when a congregation is so big that the pastor can't really know what's going on with his flock, it's probably too big. And so if you get three or four pastors and divide up the flocks, you all know who you're responsible for, okay. But there needs to be the sense of accountability and responsibility for the flock. And I think sometimes we idolize size and we forget about what we're really trying to do. And I do think there are some ideal sizes for congregations, and once you pass that, it's really hard to be a shepherd of that flock, in my opinion. You end up becoming the CEO and not really a shepherd anymore. And I don't think that's necessarily cool. And I know we have these dreams of, you know, big mega churches, but maybe what we should be doing instead is when a church starts to become successful is we start birthing a new congregation instead of just keeping on adding to this one and building our bowling alley and the Starbucks. What's that?
So amen to that, preach.
Yeah. So that's kind of where I'm at. Now, if you do have a humongous congregation and you're actually trying to be faithful to this, then who's responsible for what's going on? Well, the celebrant is. The one who is celebrating the sacrament and admitting people to the altar, he is responsible. Which, of course, is also why, if you are the celebrant and the pastor, what do you carry around with you, the bread or the wine?
Bread.
The bread, obviously, because the bread is what's admitting them to the altar. You're making the decision. You get the bread, you're receiving the sacrament. You're making the call. You go first. You have to. It's your call. And so that pastor needs to be responsible for what's going on. And I would say this. If it's a large congregation, the pastor, if he's been there a while, probably, if it's a large congregation, he should be able to look out and know every face and know what's going on. He should be able to do that. I can vouch for this. I was serving a congregation with about 500 on worship, and I could look out and say, boom, 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 I knew what's going on. I'd been there long enough. I knew what's going on. I knew those faces. I knew the families. I knew what's going on. And if I knew I had a concern, somebody I didn't know, then I would find out what's going on with that new face. I could do that. Now, if you get thousands big, then maybe the pastor just needs to actually just kind of stand in the chancel and watch who's coming to the altar at all the five different tables that are communing at once, making sure that those who are receiving as part of the body of Christ there in that place appropriately. And if it's too big to do that, it's too big. That's my answer, I guess, Adam. All right. So, yeah.
The blessing. That seems to be something that, I mean, I didn't grow up with that.
Blessing.
Where, you know, you come up and
don't take
communion, but
they're supposed to put their arms over their chest. We just won't call any attention to them at all. Okay, you're already feeling weird, and we want you to come up to the altar and do something really weird. We want you to do something nobody else does. You feel good about that, right? It's so dumb. And so I don't know where we started to throw this bone out. And you know what's the blessing anyway? You know, I don't know why bother. If somebody really wants it, you know, that's fine. I can do that. And you know, giving a blessing to kids who are not yet communing, okay, I can live with that too. But you know, what do you get? What's a blessing besides focused prayer? It's like, you know, God be with you. Sorry you can't commune. It's a rip off. But oh well. I mean, it's kind of what it amounts to, you know. And if they want to come up, fine. You know, you can give a blessing, but you know, I wouldn't encourage it necessarily.
Yeah,
I certainly wouldn't encourage it. And I wouldn't make it like a good substitute. It's no substitute. It's not. It's just something somebody came up with to try to ameliorate people. I think it's far better just to have the open conversation. You know, this is a really significant part of our worship here, and it's profoundly important. And we want you to get what's going on before you commune. And man, I want you communing with us. I really want you communing with us, but it needs to be in the right terms, in the right understanding.
Just a story that I did a house hospital visit over at St. Mary's, and a guy, you know, what can I do for you? He goes, I really need a new church. I need a church.
Yeah.
I haven't been to a church in forever.
Okay.
I said, cool. Well, when you get out of the hospital, give me a call, and, you know, we'll get you. And so I brought him to Timothy, and, you know, first time he came up, you know, we didn't give him communion.
Mm-hmm.
And he got kind of ticked off at me about that. He said, what's up with that?
Yeah.
And we explained to him, hey, uh-huh. You know, this is what we believe. brought him in to the pastors, pastor sat him down, explained every, you know, what we believe about the difference between a sacramental church and all that.
Yeah.
And do you believe?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I get that. And, you know, 2 years later, he's still there, so.
How about that?
Yeah, so, you know, that's one time. When
I know, and you can find stories on the other side of this, too. But okay, all right, Alex. Josh, sorry.
Say pastor's on vacation. Who distributes the sacrament?
Well, why are you having the sacrament if the pastor's not there? Isn't he the steward of the mysteries of God? Can somebody just step in and be his proxy? I don't think so. So do vicars should vicars be doing the sacrament when the pastor's on vacation? Answer, no. Because that's just an AC-14 thing, for crying out loud.
So you got a fill-in pastor.
Okay.
You got somebody there.
Yeah. So then fill-in pastor is going to lean heavily on the board of elders or the whoever's present who's there doing it and saying, okay, I don't know this flock, you do. And help me know what's going on here. And if you see a face you don't recognize, let me know before the service starts and just, you know, and you start, you have to rely heavily on him to do that. Yep. Okay. Okay, Kevin.
Sorry, just
no,
going back
fine.
To the...
I've got a few more things I want to get to, but go ahead.
So, in coming up and being unworthy or not appropriate, the risk is you're eating and drinking to your judgment. What do you say to the argument of people who say, well, maybe that's what God has planned for you in this moment?
Oh, well, that might be, but see, I'm the steward of the mystery of the God. Why am I going to do that to him intentionally? That's not caring for my sheep at all. That's not caring for that person. And by the way, if it's not appropriate, doesn't mean it's going to be to his harm. So in other words, if that gal who's coming back, who believes in the real presence, would commune, is she going to be harmed by her communing? No. But the fellowship will be harmed. The unity of that kind of confession will be harmed. And the understanding of that community being, we're in unity together, will be harmed. Because when somebody says, oh wait, that's Harriet's daughter. She's Presbyterian. Why is she at the altar? I thought we cared about that stuff. That harms the unity. So in other words, but will that gal be hurt? No, she isn't. She isn't a worthy recipient. We already established she's a worthy recipient. You only get damned if you're not worthy. You just mess up the unity if you're not a confessor, if you're not in confession with them. Okay? All right.
Yeah. So as a communion, as a the communion of the community.
Yeah, huge.
What do you, and you have in, especially in bigger churches, mm-hmm. like you said, when you cannot really know everybody, mm-hmm. and you have this guy who is coming first time to your congregation after 10-15 years, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but he is on the list. Mm-hmm. So formally, he confessed with mm-hmm. you, but you have no idea what's going on with him.
Yeah, right.
So
that's back to pastoral care again. That's
okay. So.
Yeah.
If he sits there, would you communion?
I would. See, I'm going to say he is part of my confession, and I want him to be better. So I will commune him. But I'm also going to say, you know, I need to go see him in January after Christmas has passed, since he shows up on Christmas Eve with his family. And I'm going to go track him down. I'm going to see what's going on. It's part of my responsibility as a shepherd. And I'm not going to feel like, oh, he got communion once a year. That's great. No, this is not adequate. I need to be a pastor of sheep. And that gets to the size thing again. And see, it's not just a matter of we can't be too big because we can't handle everybody at the rail. We can't get too big because how can a pastor really know his sheep if he's not able to visit them and spend time with them and be in their homes and have that? And this is also an argument for long pastorates, because the longer you're at a place, the more you know the people and you know all the connections. And this is one of the coolest things about after I've been at my congregation for 10 years, before I left, I could look at that congregation, I guess it was almost 10 years, I could look out at that congregation and every face, man, I knew weddings, funerals, crises, sicknesses, every face. You had all this background, all this stuff. It makes preaching so much more relevant and poignant, and it makes giving the sacrament to these people so much more significant. So long pastorates are a very cool thing, because you're able to grow with those sheep and take care of those sheep and know them. All right, now, yeah, go ahead, Caleb.
It sounds to me like confession is part of the visible church, while faith is part of the invisible church. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because this is kind of going around to the with the marks of the church kind of thing. Okay.
So if you are coming up to the altar, you are saying that I'm confessing the same as this altar, mm-hmm. which is visible church. However,
well, it's the church in its visible aspects. There's only one church.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. All
right.
So then how is, I just still can't get over the idea that someone coming up said, may not actually believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're saying that they're confessing it, so they are believing it. Or I'm still seeing this distinction between confession and faith.
Well, see, if they, you can't look in people's hearts. You take them at their confession. So if he has joined your church, he's already made a statement of what he confesses. And so you've got to take them at face value, unless you are given to believe otherwise. That's why you're not an investigator, you're not giving out an annual exam to make sure they still remember their doctrine. You're taking them at face value. And so you do put a lot of stock on, they joined the church, they made commitments, they made promises, they said, this is my confession. They did that when they joined. And you remind people of that, and you put a little more stock on that than we usually do. We kind of treat it like it's a perfunctory thing, but it's not. It's a significant thing, because they are saying, this is my confession. And you need to educate people to see what's going on there. And this is one of the things, too. When I did adult instruction class, and I got towards the end of it, I'd say, okay, this is all the stuff we believe. If you're ready to join the congregation, this is serious stuff, but please don't just do it. You know, because you're saying you're going to be part of this congregation, you're making yourself accountable, you're saying you're going to be willing to be, you know, disciplined by this congregation. If you don't want that, don't join. And I'd have people who just, okay, fine, I'm out. I'll take that over somebody joining with the wrong understanding.
It also sounds like we're putting a lot of stock in membership.
We are. And you see, membership is not just getting your box of envelopes. Membership means being part of the fellowship. And I guess I would define membership a little differently, a little more broadly. I know people get really hung up on this, you know. Okay. People don't want to join. You see, but when you're the church, you don't have a choice. You're called in. You have to. You cannot. You cannot be a Lone Ranger Christian. Can't. Christians have to be part of the church, right? We got that figured out? We agreed on that? If you're going to have God as your father, you have to have the church as your mother. You've got to be part. You don't get to be, oh, I just believe here from a distance, and I'll kind of just pick and, you know, dabble buffet style when I feel like it. You're not being that's not right. You can't do that. You've got to be part of things. So you are going to be part of it. So I don't get so hung up on, you know, have you officially signed on and gotten your box of you know, offering envelopes, which is always the criteria for full membership. Got my offering envelopes. I would say the issue is simply, is this individual willing to be under the submission of the pastor as his pastor? That makes you a member. And so this is a little bit of a kind of a judgment call. So when you have a visitor who's coming to your congregation and he's been visiting for quite a while, but he's not really officially joined yet, there comes a point when he is really part of the flock, because he'll be in submission to you. So in other words, if you went to him and say, hey, I just heard about something going on, you got to knock this off. And he wouldn't say, well, you're not my pastor. And if he would say, oh, you're right, I'm sorry, you know, well, he's basically treating you like he has acknowledged your authority. You are his pastor. And so at that point, I would say he's part of that community. And you can treat them that way. And so that's where that judgment call comes in again. You know, who, as the steward of the mysteries of God, who comes to the altar? You need to make that call, and you need to make it. And that gets back to the point I wanted to really emphasize here. I coined this term functionally open communion, which got some people pretty riled up. But I think it's right, because functionally open communion describes the vast majority of the practice, I think, that goes on in our church body. And the problem I have with it, a huge problem, is it puts the decision on the person in the pew. And see, this is the problem I have with most of our communion statements, even the most restrictive ones. You know, you got to believe this, 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 this. You got to subscribe to the entire Book of Concord. If that's your confession, you're welcome to come forward. It's still wrong, because who's made the decision? The guy sitting in the pew has. He has looked at that. He's looked in his heart, and he's decided, I belong. And he waltzes up there. It's not his decision. It's not his call. It's the congregation's decision. And who speaks for the congregation? The shepherd, the pastor. It's his call. And so anything short of the congregation welcoming guests, anything that is the idea that the guests get to decide, is getting it all backwards. And this is the real challenge of re-educating people and getting people to recognize what's really going on here. And see, this becomes then just one small aspect of a much larger discussion, like, what's the church anyway? Is the church here to meet all of your spiritual needs and give you a little shot for the week and give you the boost you need so you get a little Jesus shot? Or is the church here to form and shape and tell you what life is all about and to be the dominant thing? Which one is it? That's the much bigger discussion that needs to be going on in our churches all the time. And so this closed communion practice is just one small aspect of it. And that's one of the reasons I get fired up about this whole discussion. It's not like I'm so hung up on communion practice. I'm hung up on the whole idea of what the church is and what the pastor is in the church. So it's the pastor who needs to be making the call. While I'm thinking about it, see, this is where I got the biggest pushback on this paper. So I did this paper in Minnesota, and I came back and I said something to Dr. Aaron, my doctor father, department chair at the time, and said, I'd like to publish this. What should I send it? He says, oh, send it up to Fort Wayne. We have some conservative guys down here too. So I send it up there, and they published it like that. Yeah, we'll publish that. So that's why it's in CTQ. That's the only reason. And so I published it, and I got two or three responses. Nobody reads these journals, I think. But the one I got was a phone call right away from the current administration, and it was the one before this one. And they were, one of the representatives, it wasn't the president, was very concerned because I had suggested that not everybody in the Senate is practicing closed communion. And he said, on what basis are you saying that? I said, well, I guess it's anecdotal evidence, and every class of students I have every year telling me the same thing. But I was just stunned that he was genuinely offended that I was suggesting that not everybody in the Senate was doing closed communion. Yeah, and your response confirms my suspicions again. It's like, come on. What are you kidding yourself? So anyway, Adam.
So you've already alluded to this in class periods, but the way we do communion here on campus, where we're not actually a congregation, and some other congregation that doesn't know any of us is hosting it, and we're the ones who get to choose whether we come or not.
Well, that's not quite entirely true. But the whole idea of having a sponsoring congregation of a pastor who knows nobody is absurd. And that's one of the reasons I get so annoyed about it, because it just it gives so many wrong messages. It's just seriously weird. But who is actually then responsible for what's going on in this congregation, at this altar? Well, it's going to be probably a number of people. Ultimately, the president of the seminary. And then dean of the chapel is important. And then campus chaplain. All of these are starting to play into this. And I would say every prof, every one of us who is in the office, I'm responsible for you guys. So if I know something's going on in you guys' lives, am I going to be cool with you taking communion? Would I come to you and say, hey, we got to talk? Yeah. So what we do around here. So we are, in a sense, disciplining one another. And we aren't really a public congregation. The other thing I would say is our celebration on Wednesday mornings is not open to the public. We're not, like, advertising this. This is something that we're doing as a community. So that gives it a different kind of setting anyway. And besides, what's that?
I think they do advertise it, say you're welcome to join us.
Well, people who, but where do we advertise? In LCMS churches. Okay, we don't have a sign out in front. And the other thing is this, if you look at our statement of faith, I mean our communion statement in the bulletin, what's it say? It says that if you don't hold this confession, stay in your pew. It doesn't say, if you believe this, 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 and this, come on up. It doesn't say that. It says, those who are members in good standing are welcome to attend, but if you don't hold this, you're not, please don't come. That's bottom line. So we're basically saying, you need to check with somebody before you commune, if you're not a member of the LCMS. And I could live with that practice, but it's still not as strong as I think it should be. I think it's even better to say, if you are not part of this community, come up and talk to the celebrant before you commune. All right.
Yeah, my uncle passed away last spring, and he's Catholic, and so the Mass.
Yep.
And I thought it was very interesting. The priest basically read prior to inviting people, says, he had the who's welcome and who's not. And that's exactly what he said, was if you don't believe this, you're not, he didn't use the word, you're not welcome, but he said, he had a word, but it was verbal as opposed, in addition to written. And I think, that might be
it's a good practice.
I think it's a good practice.
It's a very good practice.
Because you can set the tone, you can say it the right way, right. You can let people know, we're so glad you're here worshiping with us today, I'm so glad you came and you're part of this celebration with us today. Now we're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper. This is a very special thing we do as a community. It expresses the unity we have in our practice and in our doctrine. Those who commune at this altar are saying they agree with everything we teach at this church. If you don't know what we teach, you haven't talked to me yet, please talk to me before you commune.
And that was a personal, it was also an invitation to come talk to me.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm the guy you talk to,
I
want to talk to
you. That's right.
So
that's right.
I think that's I noted that. I thought that was a neat practice.
I agree. I think that's a very good practice. It's actually being the church. All right, James.
Same kind of thing, even before the service starts, this almost
necessitates programming a Sunday morning so the pastor can be in the narthex.
Be available.
Be around.
Or you teach your congregation about these things. So in other words, those like ushers and elders are tuned in. They kind of get the whole culture of the congregation. So they see a visitor walk in. They don't just say, oh, thanks for coming, and give them a bulletin. They say, hey, we're celebrating the sacrament today. Are you an LCMS person? And you should go talk to the pastor. I can tell you, take you to him right now. You see, they're tuned in for this. And this reminds me of one of my really annoying stories. I was in a congregation one time, and I remember watching this happen, where there was a whole family who had come to church and were new visitors. Clearly, I was not the pastor. I was just, you know, observing. And they were clearly visitors, first time in church, and they're getting dismissed for the altar, for the sacrament. So the usher comes up, and they're sitting in the pew, and he says, come on up. And they say, and they just stay put. He says, oh, no, it's okay. Come on. And, you know, he practically drags them out of the pew. It's like, they understand better than he does. They totally got it. He was the one who was all goofed up. And so that's where you got to teach your people so they get it, and that's going on. And see, when this starts to happen, when the congregation gets it, you're not going to have a lot of these sacristy conversations. They're not going to happen. Because when the gal comes back from visiting in her back where she belongs in her Presbyterian church and comes home, what's mom and dad going to say to her? Sorry, you joined the Presbyterian church. Go to church tonight, but you can't commune. That's the way we do things around here. You know that. Yeah, I know that. Okay. You don't even have to have the conversation. Because the congregation itself gets it, and they're going to be functioning this way. But you've got to teach to get them to this point. That's part of what you do. And so, yeah, and you're not just teaching some kind of arcane, anal retentive, really hung up LCMS thing. You're teaching what it means to be the body of Christ. You're teaching them that doctrine matters. You're teaching them that confession matters. These things are not irrelevant. These things are not trivial. These things matter. That's what you're teaching. Isn't that worth teaching?
In the CTCR, it talked about like us being the gatekeeper or whatever, and how in the 1 Corinthians passage, Paul's not talking to anyone, like assuming he is the pastor talking to his people. So like what I get hung up on is in 1 Corinthians 11:28 here, mm-hmm. where it says, examine for yourselves. Mm-hmm. That to me would say, if you've examined yourself, come on up, and who am I to tell you no? So then where in Scripture do we get the... like, I as pastor and gatekeeper.
If the gatekeeper, I'm not fond of that terminology at all, because it sounds like we're, you know...
drills my point.
What's that? Well, and the whole point is that but you are the steward of the mystery. You're the one who's giving it. And so, and you can't just pass them out willy-nilly. So, and see, this is where I'm coming from. And it's kind of, you have to build the argument over several things, but if I am responsible for the flock, I'm responsible for this congregation celebration, that means I need to know that the people I'm giving this body and blood to are worthy and appropriate recipients of this body and blood. And if I don't know that, shame on me. It's my fault for not knowing that. I need to know that. Now, the person who's communing should also be, as Luther even says, the 20 questions we have in LSB, right? 20 questions to examine yourself. Why do that? To make sure that not only am I receiving worthily, but to my benefit. And that's the whole other aspect we haven't talked about, but that's the stuff we're talking about in Systems 3. So in other words, I can actually get the body and blood, but if it's going to be beneficial to me, I better be a worthy recipient. And there is some preparation that comes into play here. And the more tuned in I am, the more beneficial it'll be to me, right? That's no doubt about that. So I want my people to be piously receiving the sacrament and asking the questions, but I have my responsibility too, which is to make sure that I'm not just not up standing there like a vending machine. Here's Christ's body and blood. Hope you get it in the right way. Okay, oh, I hope you're a believer. Oh, I hope you're a confessor. Hope so. I have a responsibility to make sure those who I'm communing, I believe, are the right recipients. I need to be handling it the right way. That's what I'm getting at. That's what, to me, the stewardship of the sacrament is what's entailed there. My responsibility for oversight of what's going on in that place.
But where do we like get that scripturally? Because just where I'm pointed to when people are fighting me on this, I'm just curious, like, what would be a go-to for... Well, yeah, you point to that.
I would go to, what does it mean to be a shepherd? What's it mean to be an overseer? What's it mean to be an episcopus, a bishop? A bishop has oversight of the flock. I'm responsible for the flock. Do I have responsibility for the discipline of that whole congregation? Yes. If I see a sheep wandering away, do I need to bring them back? Yes. And so that's scriptural, no doubt about it. And so that responsibility of oversight also extends to the sacrament itself. So in other words, and see, if I'm going to be able to do church discipline and exercise the minor ban, I've got to be able to decide who gets the sacrament. That's my call. And so it is my responsibility to be giving the sacrament to those who are the ones who should be receiving the sacrament. That's part of my responsibility as part of episcopus, as part of what it means to be a shepherd. So what you're really arguing for here is not so much communion. What you're arguing for is the understanding of the office of the holy ministry. That's the issue. And that's a whole other topic. And I try to get in here too. In other words, you've got to have a right understanding of what it means to be the pastor, and then the application comes right into play. Okay? Nicholas.
I think there might be a difference in the nature of service, which is normal publicly and which you advertise, mm-hmm. and the communion, which is a closed, not even public,
that might be.
In the history. Mm-hmm. And it maybe our problems reside that we bring them so close together that they are kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
And people get confused why one part of them is kind of, oh, we want you all come in. And then, oh no, not
we don't want you on this part.
No, you're right. That does seem incongruous. That's why we need to teach people about what's going on here and why. Yeah. All right. Now, the other big aspect of this essay that I try to address was this whole law gospel problem. And I hit that on page 158 and following, where the reality is communion policy and telling somebody they can't commune, is that law or gospel? It's law. It is. It is. And that seems like, wait a minute, you've just sneaked law into the sacrament. And the sacrament's pure gospel. You can't ruin my sacrament with your stinking law. And this is where we need to do some re-education as well, because the gospel is the gospel. It's pure grace. It's pure giving. There's no law attached to it. But my responsibility for doing it is really all about the law. And it is. And that's okay. And the same thing applies to a sermon. If you preach a really good sermon, you're going to kill people with the law, and you're going to just make them soar with the gospel. And for the hearer, it's going to be like, ah, oh, that was just incredibly great gospel. Awesome. Oh, wow. But how much work was it for you to write it? And was it law or gospel when you were writing that sermon? It's law. You got to get it done. You're the one who's got to come up with the witty turn of the phrase. You're the one who's got to find the right transition. You've got to be the one who just zings the gospel at the right moment, just smashes them with the gospel. It's like, blah. That's not easy. You work, you write, you rewrite, you work it. You know what I'm talking about? So when you're cranking out a sermon, is that law or gospel when you're cranking out a sermon? It's law from beginning to end. It's a drag. It's work. It takes a lot of energy. That's why they pay you so lucratively. And so it's not an easy task. But so does that mean, oh, you just ruined it, it's not gospel anymore? No. You see, the very fact that I put the effort of law brings the gospel more clearly. It's still gospel. See, the same thing applies with evangelism. Must I go and share the gospel with other people? Is that law or gospel? It is. It's law. But when they get to hear it, is it gospel or law for them? Pure gospel. Awesome. Well, there's a little law first. We know that. You've got to kill them. Then you get to make them alive. But you see, just because we operate with understanding that there are law elements doesn't ruin the gospel. It's got to be there, in fact. It's just a necessary part of this. And it really shows a confusion of law gospel where we try to gospel everything and try to just make everything about the gospel. It doesn't work that way. And that's another whole topic for another time. You can read a book about that. But that's kind of what I'm trying to get at here, that we've got to be really careful that we don't succumb to this law-gospel reductionistic idea that law bad, gospel good, and anything that's law is inherently bad. And you're talking about closed communion, which is obviously law. That's inherently bad. We're the gospel around here. That's nonsense. But you're going to encounter that plenty of times. And you've got to be able to muster your response to that and say, oh, wait a minute. Law isn't bad. Law is the will of God. Law directs us into God's purposes, shows us how to operate. And when we are obedient to the law, this is a good thing, not a bad thing. And you need to do some teaching about that, too. And that's what I'm trying to get at there. All right. Now, the last thing I got at in this essay was the whole question, and some of you asked about this, about the cases of pastoral discretion. And the reason I bring that up is because this has become such waxen nose, as Nagel would put it, or just this kind of huge gaping loophole. So, hey, pastoral discretion. And then we start excusing all kinds of stuff as pastoral discretion. And I did make a kind of a little sarcastic comment in the document about it's more than a little convenient that going the way of the gospel is also the way that causes the less offense and puts me on the sidelines where I don't have to have difficult conversations. Oh, I'll just commune them. That let the gospel reign. So the child shows up, comes up to the altar. I don't want to deal with this. The gospel has to predominate. Here's the sacrament. Or pastoral discretion. My pastoral discretion, I realize I need to commune this person because if I don't, it's going to cause me a lot of heartache. So my pastoral discretion says I need to commune them. And that's not pastoral discretion. And even trying to avoid family pain is not pastoral discretion. Pastoral discretion is a rare thing. It doesn't become the norm. You don't say, we have the normal practice around here of communing anybody who's ELCA because we don't want to be offensive. And in our community here in northern Minnesota, it's what we need to do. That's not pastoral discretion. That's called being sloppy. That's all it is. So what does pastoral discretion look like? In my 11 years of pastoral ministry, I'd used pastoral discretion one time to commune somebody I knew who was not an appropriate recipient. But they were worthy. I would never knowingly commune an unworthy recipient, no matter what. But in one time, I broached the protocol on this, and the situation was this. I had a gal in my congregation who was dying of leukemia. She was in her young teens, 13 or 14, and her father was a member of the congregation with her, and her mother was Roman Catholic. And I was in their home, and this was in her, turned out to be her final weeks of her life, and I was there with the father and the daughter, and the mother was there, and I was bringing communion to her because she couldn't come anymore to church. And so I looked at the mother standing there looking pathetic and very sad, and I said, would you like to commune with your family? And she said, love to. So I communed all three. So did I need to? No. Is that pastoral discretion? Yeah. And you can say, well, you shouldn't have done it because she really wasn't. Yeah, I agree, you're right. But I knew that she was a worthy recipient, but she wasn't in my confession, so I didn't need to, but I did. And that was my pastoral discretion. And you can disagree with me and say, you shouldn't have done it. That's pastoral discretion. That's how it works. But I can make a case for why I did, and it seemed the right thing to do in the pastoral care there. That was my example of pastoral discretion. All right, so that's it. Questions you have on anything else in the document or arguments I'm making or sarcastic comments I make that you wanted to applaud or challenge, whatever. Yeah, David.
This is kind of maybe turning the whole issue on its head, but in kind of my season of life right now, I find myself in an ELCA church from time to time because of family. So what is your recommendation? Do I go up to the communion rail with my arms crossed? Do I not go up?
If it were me, I'd just enjoy the view from the pew. That's me. And so that's, if you ask my recommendation, that's my recommendation. You can do what you want. You want to go up and cross your arms, feel free. You know, they're probably going to look at you like, hey, get your arms down. Shove it in your mouth, you know. Hey, you get it here, man. What are you doing with your arms crossed? They're going to be perplexed by that. Yeah, exactly. They'll be totally perplexed by that.
So, but your thinking is it would communicate some level of, we believe the same thing.
Well, I think just going to church and being present says, I still respect you enough to come and worship with you guys. I can't commune with you because I'm an LCMS member of the LCMS now, and that's the way it is, but I'll still come and worship with you guys as family and stuff. I get that. I don't have a problem with that. And I think you might communicate that to those anybody who's interested. Okay? All right, Caleb?
So you think the best practice would be not a bulletin printout, but a verbal...
Oh, I think if you put something in the bulletin,
check these boxes.
If you put something in the bulletin should say something to the effect of, we're celebrating the sacrament today. If you're not part of this fellowship, please come and see the pastor. Okay. That's enough. And then if you want to make a verbal thing, you would also say basically the same thing. We're celebrating the sacrament. Come and talk to me. And if you haven't had the chance to talk to me, come and see me after the service. We'll talk about it. So next time you're ready to commune, it'll be great.
Okay. So you would go more for a... next time.
Exactly. Long-term care is what I'm looking for. I'm looking to try to build a connection and looking at actually being a pastor to this person, not just figuring out how to get the sacrament in their mouth that one Sunday. Okay? All right. Good. Other questions, comments? Yep.
Can you help me understand how God's judgment is something to always be avoided and we should always prevent people from having God's judgment be on them?
Well, I don't think that. I'm not going to put it that way. Because God's judgment is God's judgment. And when it's just, it's just. But do I want people for whom Christ died to be experiencing God's judgment? No. Does Christ want them to be experiencing judgment? No. I mean, we invite all. We want people to receive God's grace. And I don't think it's fair to say, well, if judgment comes, judgment comes. It's their problem. It's my problem. I'm the shepherd, I care too. And so what you get is the better sense of the sense of grief and loss when God's judgment comes, when no one ever celebrates it. Same idea that when you have to excommunicate somebody, it's heartbreaking. you don't celebrate that. Oh, we got rid of that guy. No, it's heartbreaking.
So you wouldn't say that God's judgment is something that should be utilized to turn people?
No. No, that's not my point. I'm not. Well, no, in other words, it's God's, well, yeah, God's wrath and God's judgment absolutely brings about repentance. It's the law, smashing down on somebody. But at the same time, I can convey that in other ways besides just giving them the sacrament and see what happens.
Okay.
But then why would you not use the sacrament if that's, if for some reason that's the only way God's judgment can be brought to them?
Wow, then that would be a remarkable situation. No, but how do I know that? How would I ever know that? How do I know that the only way that I'm going to have God's wrath fall on this guy is to give him the sacrament and have him be cursed by God? You know,